Hello, and welcome to Strange Screens. I'm your host, Laurel Tully. Together, we'll be exploring some of the World Wide Web's most intriguing communities. The purpose of Strange Screens is to explain why web users have created virtual spaces dedicated to a variety of subjects, ranging from furries to serial killer fangirls. This podcast sheds light on puzzling computerized relationships by analyzing social networks and offering the insight of experts. We attempt to understand the societal issues, personal vendettas, and psychological pressures that compel people to become part of these communities. Tumblr is perceived to be a platform where young people engage with social justice and fan culture in one place. The website is also home to thousands of blogs cataloging the lives of mass murderers that glorify violent crimes against marginalized people. Their curators treat the perpetrators like rock stars. Some have even followed in their bloody footsteps. Our pilot episode is dedicated to this infamous cohort of Tumblr bloggers, the true crime community. The disturbing antics of these murder fanatics have earned them coverage by the YouTuber Savantix and Strange Aeons, whose channels are dedicated to their respective deep dives into niche online spaces. While these videos offer glimpses into the true crime community's territory, neither vlogger probes at why a fandom glorifying violent criminals might surface on an unmoderated yet mainstream platform like Tumblr. The true crime community has long been the target of ire for many internet users, often for its members' inflammatory declarations of sympathy for fascist terrorists, school shooters, and serial killers. Although not every blogger in the fandom has violent tendencies, several criminals have been traced back to the community after committing heinous serial murders. The Sandy Hook shooter posted collages of Columbine corpses on his Tumblr blogs titled after other killers, before slaying 26 people in 2012. One user, Brianne Bosserick, called mass murderer Dylan Roof precious and handsome, posted baby pictures of school shooter Nicholas Cruz, and early last year, she was arrested for threatening to kill people herself. She wrote, "I had a vision of a very public place, only one way in and one way out, preferably a bar or a club on a busy night. 2019 has a lot in store if my plans go according." To generalize the entire true crime community as a fandom of sociopaths would be unfair. The Tumblr community draws in a motley crowd. Some are benevolent crime researchers and armchair detectives. Others enjoy the popular view of killers as misunderstood loners. And another, more alarming group, seemingly consists of women depicting criminals as desirable celebrities. Bosserick was part of the killer-worshipping sect. Her Tumblr was a monument to murderers made distinct by her public agreement with their motives. However, it was Bosserick's romantic interest in terrorist Dylan Roof that made her typical of a large subset of Tumblr's true crime community. The romantic element of the fandom is similar to the phenomenon on death row, where women seek relationships with men serving life for cruel acts they may have even admitted to. Sheila Eisenberg, author of Women Who Love Men Who Kill, spoke with dozens of women who had relationships with murderers. She identified two primary groups of people that romance murderers: those who believe that they appeal to the true, gentle nature of a violent criminal, and those who start relationships with infamous felons because they seek the same notoriety. From her research, Eisenberg concludes that for a lot of these women, a relationship such as this is a power move. She said in a CNN interview, "A lot of these women have come from abusive childhoods or were battered women. Some were physically, psychologically, or verbally abused, but they were all victims. I came up with theory that if you are in a relationship with a man who is behind bars for life or on death row, he can't hurt you. You're in the driver's seat and in control for maybe the first time in your life." The fantasy of the perfect boyfriend would come crumbling down around the brides of offenders if prison walls disappeared. The true crime fans who fetishize terrorists and school shooters would meet a similar fate if it were not for the safety of an online space. Protected by aliases and geographic distance, these women can safely profess their love for men who might desire to make them an unwilling victim of a horrific crime. In order to probe deeper at the question of why women seek out relationships with men who have violent pasts, I've invited Jaya Bali to speak about her experiences working as a victim's advocate for over 3 years. Jaya can offer her perspective as a domestic violence shelter caseworker to assess why some women seem determined to live by the sides of abusers despite the pain they continuously inflict. Hi, Jaya. Can you describe the work that you've done for the District Alliance for Safe Housing and the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network?
Yeah, so I have been working with RAIN for about 3.5 years in various roles, taking calls and chats and basically servicing survivors of sexual violence, both civilians and those within the United States military. I also have spent time working as a case manager at a DC domestic violence shelter. So case management basically involves kind of following up with day-to-day survivors as they come in. We were a 2-year transitional housing program, so our survivors stayed with us for quite a period of time, did allow for a lot of insight and consistency. So I got to learn a lot from the people that I worked with because they did stay with us for quite some time instead of having a 30-day rotating type of system.
According to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, it typically takes about 7 attempts for a person to leave an abuser. Can you speak on this perceived refusal by victims to escape a dangerous situation?
Yeah, so that statistic is definitely something that I think echoed true in my work at the shelter. A lot of our survivors had been in domestic violence shelters more than once. This was not their first go-around. Survivors also, you know, did bring and try to bring abusers into the shelters, and for various reasons, I think, as well. Like, there were some who were, like, that was the baby's father. There were some who were still, you know, feeling like they wanted to bring this person back into their life, even though they'd, you know, procured safe housing. So definitely, that was situations that we saw.
Why do you think that women in particular have difficulty leaving men despite their partner's violent history?
I think that's something that I definitely noticed quite a bit at the shelter. And it was definitely something that took me by surprise at first, especially because the location of our shelter is undisclosed. So besides the survivor who finds out the location the day of and when they're arriving, nobody knows the location. And, you know, at first I was like, this is a great opportunity for survivors to be able to move forward. But we did have quite a few situations where the abusers would show up because the survivor did give this person the address.
Have you ever encountered a situation where it appeared that a victim was aware of the abuser's past acts of cruelty towards others, but chose to engage despite that knowledge?
I think there's definitely a lot of reasons for that. I think some of them are situational, systematic. For example, a lot of the residents that I worked with had children with the abuser, and they felt that, you know, culturally and societally, they needed to have a man and a woman in this relationship in order for their child to grow up healthy and structured and balanced. I mean, I think there's also like very specific barriers as well. Like if you talk about finances, if you talk about networks and connections, you know, abusers often limit a lot of those things so that the survivor does not really have a lot of method and means to leave. And sometimes, you know, I think even a want to leave sometimes because they don't know of another life. They can't imagine a different situation.
Do you think a similar desire for reputation leads internet users to dedicate their romantic fantasies to infamous murderers?
A lot of our survivors, I actually did notice this with. In particular, we had a couple of cases where the survivor was a, you know, victim of an escaping from a gang life and gang violence. The person they were dating was part of the gang, and somebody they knew perpetuated acts of violence, but this was something that, you know, especially if your family was part of the gang, your friends are part of the gang, joining the gang and dating somebody who was extremely violent was not only, you know, something that was expected of you, but was something that, you know, guarantees you some protection in a world that you feel like you have to be in. I think sometimes diminishing violence is a part of survival, I think, especially when you're dealing with people who've experienced violence for such a long time. And I guess in regards to violence and, you know, the dismissal of violence, I think violence for a lot of our survivors that I work with was something that they could explain and they could understand and they could also predict. Like, I worked with a very young person in their very early 20s, like barely even 21. And this person had hit her, and she was able, like, in her head, she was like, I can explain why this person hit me, but she was like, I have talked to men who have been just so kind and so sweet, and she's like, I can't explain that, you know, I don't, she was like, I can't explain kindness, but I can explain violence, because there's a motive there, there's love, there's care, there's something there, you know. And I think we live in a world where, you know, men's emotions are explained through violence. So I think for a lot of people, that's something that makes sense, as unfortunate as that is.
Now that we've discussed the details of your experience working with victim populations, as well as your feelings on the true crime community, I must ask, what do you feel is the main contributing factor that causes women to fall for abusers who have committed violent crimes like mass murder?
I mean, I can definitely see the correlation there. I think there are a lot of cases, you know, as I was mentioning before, toxic masculinity plays a huge role in how we see men expressing their emotions. In regards to, like, internet communities, as you've talked about, I mean, I can imagine, like, if you think about, like, a housewife, for example, maybe somebody who's bored with their life, who's tired, who, you know, they kind of are in the same routine every day. They come home to a spouse who is not abusive, is not violent, but also is not overly affectionate or loving, doesn't seem to care. And I think to see an internet murderer, like, unfortunately, a lot of people read violence as passion. They read violence as emotion. They read that as something. So to, like, live a life with lack of feeling and to see that, like, I can see how there's an appeal to that. Because again, I think a lot of times there is this desire to, you know, put this understanding behind violence, to reason that there's that, you know, that somebody's committing violence because there's a feeling behind it, when in reality, sometimes violence is just violence. Violence is not love. Violence is not, you know, feelings. Violence is just somebody's uncontrollable, you know, anger and uncontrollable inability to understand that, you know, inability to care about another person.